What is up? We are back. Tony in the Field.
Tony in the Field. Oh, my God. I love those guys.
So excited to be on Tony in the Field. Love the show.
Oh, man. I can't wait. I'm fired. Preston, what's on the menu, brother?
The gloves are coming off.
James catches, puts up a three. Won't go. Rebound box. Back out to Allen. History final. Bang! Tie game with 5 seconds remaining.
Swoops. Dancing for the win! Texas is back, folks!
Indiana's 9 out of 12.
Oh! Gerald Green! That's a man's jam!
Hey, what is up, everybody? This is Tony and the Field. We are coming to you live on Wednesday, September 16th, recording just short of 8 o'clock Pacific time. I'm the Field, a.k.a. Preston Highfield, holding it down in Portland, Oregon. He is Tony, a.k.a. Big Tony, holding it down in the beautiful Bay Area. Coming up on the pod, we will talk Pac-12 and Big Ten resurging and trying to make a comeback into the college football world. Should they be doing it? How risky is it? Is it fair to the players? We'll break down those topics real quick, but we really want to talk NBA, the Clippers' monumental Game 7 meltdown against the Nuggets, Celtics Heat Game 1, NFL Week 1 thoughts, and then we'll close it out with any final thoughts we have. I know Big Tony has a couple funny nuggets for you folks at the end of the show. What's going on, man?
Funny nuggets. I like what you did there. That's pretty solid. The Burger King Denver Nuggets, folks. Pulling off the 3-1 comeback. What's going on, Chief Man? Good to be back on the mic, dog. We got a loaded show, and we hope that all of our great listeners are going to enjoy this. But yeah, we got a lot to break down, and I know we're going to start heavy, man. So I'll let you take the wheel here and get us into our first topic.
Appreciate it. And folks, just to give you a heads up as well, we will have Steve Mims of the Register Guard next week on our
Let's
podcast.
Go.
Really, really great dude in the Eugene media scene, longtime writer. He was actually at the Register Guard for, I believe, 21 years. So definitely a Hall of Famer in the Eugene market who put in his time. Much respect to Steve Mims, an industry vet. And he recently announced a switch of careers to the financial services side of New York life. Kind of interestingly enough, he's still in Eugene. But I talked to him about his career switch earlier this week. We talked on the phone for maybe 25 minutes or so and shot him an invite to come on the pod. And he's coming on next week. So you guys know how much we love breaking down the industry and chatting with folks in the industry, particularly industry vets. And definitely Big Tony, I know you and I are both pumped to get his perspective on just how the industry's kind of changed over the years, too.
Can I just say really quickly, I know we have the interview next week, but shout out to Steve Mims from a personal level. I remember Steve being a great guy, but I remember him grinding, man. I remember him putting in, it's not like everyone else didn't work hard, but Steve was one of the few dudes that I remember that would come to every single baseball media availability. And that is just an example of how hard that he worked, because that was something that a lot of other people in the industry didn't go to on a consistent basis just because their schedules didn't allow it. But he was there for every single one of those, and he was still covering other sports, right? Like, he wasn't just a baseball beat. He was covering basketball. He was covering football. That guy was he was dedicated to the craft, and he was always there no matter what the event was. So shout out to that guy for putting in a ton of time. That's what we like to call a true industry vet.
Well said. You know, the grind, the two biggest grinds, I would say, in the Eugene media scene, as someone who was not only there in college, but 3 years afterwards in the local TV scene, putting in the grind work myself. The two of the biggest grinding moments in Eugene local media are the Tuesday college baseball availabilities on a rainy spring day when it's 42 degrees, wind is whipping, rain is whipping into your face. And you got to ask George Horton about the upcoming series that, quite frankly, not many folks outside of Eugene care about, or even in Eugene. And then the Eugene Emeralds games, which, by the way, shout out to the Ems. They do a good job of making it fun for the fans. They actually do get a really good turnout, but it's just a grind. Those minor league baseball nights where first pitch is at 7:05. And you know you're going to be working until about midnight that night. So big shout out to Steve. Definitely pumped. He's going to have I promise you, folks, he's going to have some great, great stories for us. I already actually started asking him about a couple. He's going to have some great stories for us. So you definitely won't want to miss that interview next week with Steve Mims of the RG. All right. Topics tonight, folks. We're talking Clippers meltdown. We're talking Celtics Heat game one, the NFL. And like I mentioned, Tony's going to have some final funny nuggets or tidbits, if you will, at the end of the show. But first, we actually want to quickly hit on the Pac-12 and Big Ten coming back into play. So the Big Ten sounds like is going to resume play October 24th. Apparently, they're going to attempt to play 8 conference games and essentially give themselves an opportunity to get into the New Year's 6 games and college football playoff games, which is very smart from a financial standpoint. And that their conference title game will be December 19th, the week before Christmas. That brings the Pac-12 into the equation. Twitter was kind of crazy today. I try to stay away from it as much as I can, but with how much I genuinely care about college football and Pac-12 football, I was on Twitter a lot of the day just reading John Wilner and John Canzano and Kyle Bonagura and the rest of the folks who have been on the beat of this adventure that is the Pac-12 trying to return. Some folks were quoting Larry Scott saying that, and actually Larry Scott did say this. I was on a Zoom call where Larry Scott was speaking last week, and he said that the state of California and the state of Oregon still needed government approval to even start practicing. Then Gavin Newsom came out today and said the state of California at the college level has always had the government approval, which essentially you need an OHA exemption or a health authority exemption. I believe OHA might be the Oregon one, and there's a, you know, maybe the California health exemption as well. Point being, after much discussion, I don't want to call it fake news because I think people were trying to do their job correctly. A lot of these writers who I know, after much discussion and many different facts thrown out there and different reports thrown out there, it sounds like the governments have given the state of Oregon and the state of California approval for their Pac-12 schools to resume practices and resume college football. There might be some little tidbits here and there where they can only practice in groups of 12s, but that sounds like that'll actually get cleared up to where they can actually practice fully as a team. Point being, overall, once the Pac-12 submits its plan to those two government authorities, if you will, the state of California and the state of Oregon, the Pac-12 can resume play. It's all a lot to think about, to discuss. I don't even think there are really any thrilling discussion points, Tony, but I know that we both kind of, you know, we have a Pac-12 audience. We wanted to bring it up and talk about what kind of a mess it's been and see if the Pac-12 can get back into the college football playoff and New Year's 6 discussion, or if it's going to be too late if they resume their season in mid-November. I'll give you the floor here just as I kind of teed that up with the reports and information that various reporters and then governors shared today. Just your thoughts on this whole college football ordeal, particularly with the Pac-12 and Big Ten trying to return to play.
It's madness. It really is. I have an entire take here that I could go on, but it would be sort of a rabbit hole. So let me just ask you this question first. Does any of this happen if the SEC, ACC, and Big 12 don't play?
No, I don't think so. I think if those schools aren't playing, I would say the other major conferences wouldn't play either.
That's what it feels like to me. It really does feel like a situation where the Big Ten and the Pac-12 are looking around at their peers and these other conferences, not just the other Big Three, but other smaller conferences like the American, for example, are already playing games. Notre Dame's playing games. Clemson's playing games. Well, why are we missing out on this? And from my perspective, I hate to beat this drum all the time, but it's kind of crazy to think about it from the student athlete's perspective, right, Chief? I mean, this is just yet another risk that only the student athletes are going to have to take, and yet they're still unpaid. And for football players, add this on top of all the other things that they have to deal with playing football, and it's just another daily hurdle, right, in the life of a collegiate football player. There's still money to be made. It's still the biggest revenue generator for the athletic department and the NCAA. So let's just go out there and strap it up, right? I mean, that's what it looks like. It just looks like the other schools weren't going to miss out on it because, I mean, let's be honest, there could be a zombie apocalypse in the South and there would still be football on Saturdays at Tiger Stadium, right? The SEC was never going to miss out on a college football season. And so that combined with the Big 12 and the ACC, Clemson played last weekend. And the Pac-12 and the Big 10, in my opinion, are looking at there with their pants down, saying to themselves, well, if they're playing, why can't we play? We're not going to miss out on this too. Let's just scramble and try to throw something together. So I hate to look at this glass half empty, but it's just kind of crazy to me when you think about it in that light, isn't it?
It is. And you brought this up before the show, and I watched this quote too on SportsCenter last night, how Coach O very like subtly and almost nonchalantly said during one of his press conferences, yeah, I think like most of our guys have already had the coronavirus and, you know, they're recovering and they'll be able to go through the 90-day test period with the SEC, so they won't get tested for another 90 days. So I think most of them will be able to play the season without getting held off the field. I'm paraphrasing, but that's pretty much exactly what he said. And it was like, what? Like, you just casually said, like, most of your team has already had coronavirus. And I know that Clemson has had, I think, maybe 25 to 50 players that have had it. Texas Tech's numbers have been in the high 70s that they've self-reported. It's nuts. I do contend that I've always said this, and there have been columns written about it. And in fact, some of the quotes that have come out of these Big Ten meetings by writers from The Athletic have shared this sentiment as well, which is many folks think that it's actually safer for the players to be in their little bubble because they get tested. Now they'll get tested daily in the Pac-12 and the Big Ten and in the SEC, et cetera. I think they're testing like three times a week, those other conferences. I know the Big Ten was testing at least three times a week before they shut it down. So I actually do think in the sense of the safest possible manner, first of all, none of us are doctors. None of us have a perfect answer. There's a reason this thing is being dragged on and politicized, and there's a bunch of different sides to the argument. It's because there's no perfect answer. So let's just say that. But I also do contend that these players are perhaps safer. And again, there's no way to say this for sure, but they're perhaps safer getting tested every day, being in their little, you know, quote unquote football bubble on campus, holding each other accountable. Hey, starting receiver X, like, don't go to that party. We need you against USC this week. Like, I'm sure that there's going to be a lot of peer accountability, if you will. So I actually think that it's kind of safer to play. The crazy part is, like you mentioned, how these players aren't getting paid and they're getting dragged through this. And they actually want to play for the most part. We've seen the hashtag "We Want to Play," where those, you know, written statements get signed off by people. Amon-Ra St. Brown, the USC receiver, wrote in coalition with other USC players that big document that he submitted on Twitter directed at Gavin Newsom. So it seems like most of the players want to play. But I agree, this discussion and all college discussions usually come back to, but the players aren't making money and yet they're taking on the most risk. That's a bummer, but that's what college sports is right now.
Yeah, it's finance 101, right? The more risk that you incur, the higher the reward should in theory be. It's the only labor market that I know of that has a completely backwards business model. And that's what it looks like it is once again, right? I mean, thinking of this as just another business transaction. So it's kind of sad in that respect. You said it pretty well. None of us are doctors. None of us know the perfect answer because there isn't one. So I don't want to get into all the numbers and the statistics and what's safer and what isn't safer, but it's just kind of crazy how everything is unfolded. And, you know, it's the season's back on and it's just, we're going to strap it up and we're going to throw them out there and see what happens. And I just sincerely pray that no one gets seriously injured as always, but has like a serious health defect or any sort of ramifications that comes from playing and potentially contracting the virus.
Florida at Ole Miss, September 26th, baby. Oxford, yeah, Mississippi, that was never in doubt. Lane Kiffin, just win, baby.
That was never in doubt. I mean, come on, the SEC, Chief, seriously, there could be nuclear bomb threats in the South. You think they're not strapping up on Saturdays?
Oh, they're strapping up, and CBS is putting that sky cam in up above Tiger Stadium to get those aerial shots of Baton Rouge.
You think Danielson's not calling those Saturday mornings? Come on now. You thought for a second, folks, that Danielson wouldn't be on the SEC on CBS on Saturday mornings on the West Coast, noon on the East.
You thought for a second that the Tennessee Volunteers weren't going to strap up. Come on, folks.
That's just not how it works down there.
It's not. It's a whole different world down there, folks. I'm telling you. You don't see it on TV much. But Trump won the election for a reason, folks. It's a whole different it's a whole different world down there that we don't see much of. All right, Big Tony. The Clippers and their monumental meltdown against the Nuggets.
Historic.
Folks, Twitter was – it is historic, particularly from the Nuggets side. No team had ever come back from 3-1 down in two different series in the same postseason. Only 13 teams have ever come back from 3-1 down in a series. I don't even know where to start. Twitter was on fire last night. I remember texting Pierce and saying this is about to be a hysterical night on Twitter with about 5 minutes left in that fourth quarter when Paul George hit the side of the backboard on that wide open corner three and Malone called the timeout. They were up 15. They showed an ISO shot of Doc Rivers and he was like, I mean, you could see in his face. He was like, yep, we're done. We're absolutely done. They were down 15 with 4.5 minutes left or whatever it was. There's a million different angles we can take here. I don't even know where to start. I mean, I'll say, first of all, you know, Jamal Murray and Nikola Jokic, just unbelievable. Jamal Murray is 23 years old. He's 23. Nikola Jokic, like, just turned 25. Jokic with just some wizard-like passing. His stat line was, like, 16, 20, and 13 or something along those lines, which is insane. Jamal Murray with a 40-piece. And by the way, both players played well in the clutch. And I think the reason so many of us, I'll put myself out there, enjoyed watching this monumental historic collapse from the Clippers is because of how cocky they'd been all season. And they somewhat had the right to be cocky. I mean, Kawhi is, I'm not going to overreact in the sense of I never put Kawhi in LeBron's category, but I'm also not going to overreact and be like, he's not one of the five best players. Kawhi's still one of the five best players in the world. I'm not saying that, but they had a reason to be cocky because they had an NBA champion and an NBA Finals MVP on their side all of a sudden. But man, it felt so good to watch a team like with guys like Pat Bev and Trez Harrell who are over the line at times. I think folks can agree on
and
that.
And Morris.
Morris, who's over the line at times, he had a couple dirty plays in that Mavericks series that, you know, stepping on Luka's foot, and he had another dirty play or two that just wasn't cool. Quite frankly, Paul George is a guy who acts like a superstar, treats himself like a superstar, and time again fails miserably when it matters most. 4 of 16 last night. Kawhi, 6 of 22. Again, I'm not going to like slander Kawhi too much. We've seen him deliver against the greatest teams there are. But man, it felt, I'm just going to be honest, it felt so good watching Paul George and the rest of this Clippers team fail after being so cocky and sticking their chest out all season and not even making the conference finals. Paul George, 4 for 16, Kawhi, 6 for 22. Combined, they were 0 for 11 for 0 points in the fourth quarter. Not even a point at the free throw line. The team didn't score a field goal for the first 7 minutes of the fourth quarter. Let me say that again. The team did not score a field goal for the first 7 minutes of the fourth quarter. I could keep going on, but Big Tony, I'll just hand it to you for your initial reaction.
First of all, Stephen A. Voice. First of all, yeah. It's teed up well. I gotta be honest here. I thought the Clippers were going to win the entire season. I thought that with their loaded roster and with their superstar power, and especially with Kawhi, who had been there before and done it on the biggest stage against multiple teams with multiple teams, I thought that their depth and their 1 through 10 was the best in the league. And I didn't think that in 7 games, anyone could beat them 4 times on paper. I still don't think I was wrong, but I was very wrong about the chemistry. I just got to admit it. When you're wrong, you're wrong. I'll take the L here. I'll take the rips. I'll take the slander. The Clippers flat out got embarrassed. They choked. They didn't have the chemistry, and they didn't come up clutch when it mattered most. It's bizarre how they lost. It isn't just on one thing. A lot of it has to do with Kawhi in that last game. A lot of it has to do with Paul George in multiple games. Probably a good amount of it has to do with Doc Rivers. He's maybe not the best coach, and he's choked a number of times throughout his career. I think I read something the other day where he is the only coach that has blown a 3-1 lead three times. So there's something there as well. Maybe he's just not the best man for the job, but I mean, he'll run it back and we'll see what they do next year. A lot of the role players didn't show up in a lot of the important games. Role players do matter, folks, especially in the playoffs. A lot of it's on the superstars, but those 3 through 8, 9, 10 rotations, they matter too. So it was all kind of a perfect storm. And then that game 7 was just hysterical. I think it was like 30 something points that the Clippers scored in the second half. And that was a common theme throughout games 5, 6, and 7. They just could not score in the second half. And Denver was making absolutely everything. You got to give a lot of credit, like you said, to Murray and Jokic. I can't believe how well Murray's been playing, man. Someone posted his stat line for the playoffs on Twitter that I just caught before this show, Chief. 50, 49, 90. Let me say that again. Almost one percentage point away from being in the 50, 50, 90 club for the playoffs. That's insane. So field goal percentage, three-point percentage, free throw percentage. I mean, like you said, he's 23 years old, and he is absolutely balling out in the clutch. 3-1 back down for back-to-back series. So that's wild. Jokic, I still don't understand how he's so good. It makes no sense. It defies all athleticism and logic, but incredible player. Yeah, like you said, historic meltdown. I got to take the L on this one. I thought they were going to win. I thought they were going to win the whole time, but they just did not have it. A lot of dirty players on that team. I can't root for all of them. Hard to defend Paul George at this point. Kawhi, one terrible game in game 7, but you know, hard to slander him too much based on his resume. Yeah, that's pretty much all I got off the top. It was as shocking to me as I'm sure it was to everyone else.
They scored 8 points in the fourth quarter. I like, and by the way, I think like 4 of those were like complete garbage time Harold dunks when the Clippers were up like, or pardon me, when the Nuggets were up like 20 in the last 2 minutes. They basically barely scored the entire fourth quarter. And I don't know how to explain. I know how to explain the Paul George stuff because, brother, we've seen this time and time and time again. I don't know how to explain the Kawhi stuff. 6 of 22. And he's never been like an elite shooter, but his mid-range is darn good. I'm honestly curious to get your thoughts on what happened offensively in that fourth quarter. I think they just got tight. Like
got tight.
Spare me the "we're tired" thing. Like I Bill Simmons earlier on the Russillo Bill Simmons pod was like, I think they were kind of tired, but that's not an excuse. I'm like, what? Kind of tired? It's game 7. It's only the second round. They're not at the end of like some insane playoff run. They basically load managed the entire year, and they're, you know, they would say they beat the Mavs in 6. So that was only their 13th playoff game, but they had like 3 months off before that. Before the, what do you mean you're tired?
They must have come out of shape, maybe.
I think they just choked. The Paul George hitting the side of the backboard on a wide open corner 3, and Kawhi just not, I mean, he was taking like pretty good shots, but none of them were going in. But like, I mean, if you're a superstar of pretty much the highest order, I actually ranked a whole list of NBA players today because I have some time on my hands these days. And I went down and listed my top like 20-ish players in the league. I have LeBron and KD in their own 1-2 category and then a little bit of a gap. But I have Kawhi, Giannis, and AD as my next 3. If you're like that good, the way that Kawhi is, and he's pretty much universally accepted as a top 5 player, like you got to get to the free throw line or something, bro. You can't just be shooting like fadeaway 3s and hoping they go in, or turn around double contested mid ranges. Like, you got to take over and get to the line or something. I mean, what in your estimation happened in the fourth quarter? It was pretty much just a choke, wasn't it?
Yeah, they got tight. They got tight. Paul George, like you said, we've seen that before, hitting the side of the backboard and then also just like short on wide open looks. That's a mental thing for sure. The dude got tight. That's just as simple as that. The rest of the guys, they look scared too. Kawhi was trying to make it work, and he was actually getting good looks, but they just weren't going in. That didn't look like a mental thing to me. That just looked like he was just missing shots, whereas Paul George looks more or less scared, and the rest of those dudes look more or less scared to shoot. Weird, man. I've never seen anything like that where the Nuggets were making absolutely everything that they were shooting, and the Clippers were just not putting the ball through the rim. Truly bizarre. I really do think that it came down to them just having a ton of nerves in that fourth quarter. And I mean, once it got to that double digit margin, that was it. There was a lid on the rim for the Clips. Nuggets were in complete control. They were playing with house money the whole time. They didn't care. That's why they were so calm and chilling and just playing so well in those second halves. Didn't matter how much they were down. They expected to go home at that point anyway. So yeah, man, with Paul George, I can't defend him in the playoffs at this point. Great talent, great two-way player. He was first-team All-NBA and first-team All-Defensive NBA for a reason, and third in the MVP voting, I think, a few years ago. But come playoff time, I don't know what's going on, man. He definitely breaks down, and he's had so many bad playoff games to the point that you can't defend him in the playoffs anymore. With Kawhi, that's a completely different story. He had a bad game. Now, it was a terrible game to have a bad game in the game seven of a series, right? To blow a 3-1 lead. But for the playoffs, Kawhi went 28-9-5. And for his numbers in other playoffs, especially last year's, I mean, one bad game, I'm not going to look too much into that. Like, that dude is still an elite player and was, until last night, Mr. Consistent. I think he'd only had one bad playoff game before that. So I'm not looking at that Kawhi stuff at all, but the Paul George thing is real, and that dude needs to figure out his playoff woes.
Yeah, I'm totally with you on Kawhi. I do think if like LeBron or even KD had a game like that, they would be getting slandered extremely hard.
And they have before.
And I don't think Kawhi was getting slandered that hard. And I think that's because a lot of people don't quite put him in the category, which is not in any way like a diss. I think we all still agree he's like a top five player, and at times, you know, in a series can be a maybe the best player. But I agree. I'm not calling Kawhi out too much. I mean, you should criticize him somewhat. Like, bro, everyone's saying you're the best player in the world at the moment.
For sure.
6-22. It was miserable, but he obviously proved himself last year. He's proved himself in the past. So I do like what he said in the post game. I watched a little bit of the post game from Kawhi and PG and Doc, just the sound bites they were running on SportsCenter. Kawhi said something pretty intelligent. He said, you know, we have to get smarter. We have to like play better situational basketball. I'm paraphrasing, but he did use the word smart. You know, it's essentially like we have to get smarter. We have to, you know, play better situational basketball. He didn't speak too much to the chemistry. Paul George essentially, and this is why another reason why I go at Paul George so much is the guy never takes ownership for anything but acts like a superstar. I mean, it's always someone else's fault. It's always a different excuse. Last night, his excuse was,
"That's fair."
Well, this wasn't a championship or bust year. That's what he said. He was like, "This wasn't a championship or bust. We just feel like we're barely playing together." You know, like, dude, have some accountability. If you're a star, I mean, take it on the chin, man. I mean, we've seen LeBron take it on the chin. We've seen last night, I thought Kawhi took it on the chin very well. He said, we just weren't good enough. We need to get smarter. He talked about like legitimate basketball reasons why the team needs to improve, not just, oh, I mean, I don't know why you're looking at us. We, you know, we're not a championship or bust team, which is exactly what Paul George said. And that's always been my beef with Pandemic P, or Way Off P, as folks were saying last night on Twitter, is that he carries himself like a superstar. He acts like a superstar, and then he deflects and makes excuses after poor playoff performances. And I'm done with it. I'm just dumb. I'm done with it. So anyways, those were my two kind of post game notes. Doc also kind of appropriately took it on the chin, said, I'm the coach. It was my bad. I don't know if he'll be back next year. I don't know if they need to change coaches or what. But I mean, are you buying the whole chemistry argument, Big Tony? That they really had a breakdown in chemistry and that's why they didn't win, or did they just kind of choke?
Well, saying they just choked is putting it too vaguely. Like, you got to drill down there, right? So yeah, the chemistry definitely has a lot to do with it. They had so much talent. Like I said, on paper, 1 through 10, the most talented team in the league. But there are a lot of mouths to feed, and I just think that they didn't do a good job of moving the ball, and it got stale. And you know, ultimately, it was hero ball, and then they got tight, and then people didn't want to take shots. So you put yourself in that position, you only have yourselves to blame. So yeah, chemistry has a lot to do with it. The fatigue, really quickly, let me address that. Could have been a thing, honestly, because maybe some guys came into the bubble out of shape. That's a legitimate thing. I can kind of buy that, but you know,
Magic
game City,
baby.
Magic City. Lou Will had to get those wings, dog. Had to get those wings, man, and catfish nuggets. But yeah, I mean, maybe that did play a factor into it. I don't know. I saw an article today talking about how there were Clippers saying they couldn't play more than 3 minutes. They were begging to be subbed out. I don't know the level of confidence or validity into any of that. And I certainly don't think it's a great excuse. But yeah, I mean, it's possible that they could have been out of shape coming into the bubble, and that restart hurt them. Last thing I'll say, though, you talk about if that had ever happened to LeBron, then he would get killed. It did happen to LeBron in 2011. It happened in an entire final series where he played like ass, and he got exposed, and everyone was all over him. So slander was real there. And for Kawhi, I mean, it was real last night. He's got to take some ownership. It was a bad game for sure. But for Paul George, you know, it's bad as well, as because he's had it throughout his entire career. These moments have happened to everyone, right? They even happened to KD too back in 2016 when he blew the original 3-1 lead to the Warriors. So they happened to everyone. Everyone gets the slander. That's the nature of the game, right? Especially on Twitter. You're not going to Twitter for intelligent basketball takes. You're going to Twitter to rip on people after games. That's all it is. Everyone gets it. It's just the nature of the game.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, LeBron in 2011, 18-7-7 on 48% shooting, and he definitely got torched for for that. Granted, it was on a much bigger stage against probably a better team, but I totally hear what you're saying. I made a quick list of players who I would – very quickly, this is my last Paul George thing because I can't I can't get enough of ripping Pandemic Pete. This is my very last Paul George thing, though. I made a quick list of players – who, in my personal opinion, are better than Playoff P, / I would rather have on my team. Let me give you this list and tell me if you disagree with any of them.
All right, let's hear
LeBron,
it.
LeBron, KD, AD, Giannis, Kawhi, Steph, Lillard, Harden, Embiid, Jokic, Jamal Murray, Klay Thompson, Kyrie Irving, Donovan Mitchell, Jimmy Butler, Jason Tatum, Ben Simmons, Chris Paul.
I don't know about Chris Paul or Ben Simmons. Ben Simmons, like, literally can't shoot at all. At least Paul George can sometimes shoot. And Chris Paul is old as hell. But I guess in a couple of playoff series, Chris Paul over Paul George. And I guess if you already have shooters, put Ben Simmons in there. I'm not really sold on Ben Simmons, but yeah, everyone else, that sounds pretty solid to me.
Okay. Moving forward for the Clippers, in your opinion, Big Tony, I mean, what do they do? Like, do they just run it back next year? I know they have a couple free agents. I think Trez Harrell's a free agent, and maybe Lou Will, a couple of their role players are. And I don't think they have much cap room. I think they have the good old MLE to use on one player. And then Doc. Folks are talking about Doc maybe going to the 76ers instead. And them upgrading or at least just promoting, I should say, Ty Lue to the head coaching position. Do they just run it back next year? I mean, what do you do if you're the Clippers?
I mean, yeah, they're fine. They still have the most talent in the league. All they need to do is just figure out the freaking chemistry in the rotations. So that means that they need to move the ball more, especially in those games where it gets tight, and they need to keep playing defense. They stop moving the ball, and then they stop playing defense, and then it comes down to a game 7, and people are scared to shoot. I mean, it's just as simple as that from what they were actually doing out there from like a personnel X's and O standpoint. And then as far as Kawhi, he's fine. But Paul George, the two superstars of that team, Paul George needs to get some help for sure, especially in the playoffs. I mean, these playoff performances, at this point, there's no defending them, and it's a common occurrence, common enough to where you probably need some counseling, some extra film, an expert to come in there and kind of assess what's going wrong. And then I think the rest of the players, I don't know their contract situation, but they have solid role players if they can keep most of them and then maybe sign an MLE. I think they should be fine enough to run it back. They just need to figure out their chemistry and see what's going on with Paul George when the playoffs come around.
I agree. I don't think there's any reason to push the panic button. I would definitely give Doc one more year with the players. You know, I think it's overreaction city today, 24 hours after it's happened. But that being said, it was a historically bad joke to play, especially because your team is comprised mostly of vets, and the Nuggets outside of like Paul Millsap are mostly like 23, 24, 25 year old dudes. So for those 30 year old guys in their prime to just joke, I mean, it's just nuts. It's just nuts. So yeah, we'll see what the Clips do moving forward. I guess to give the Nuggets some praise, and of course that's what we all want to do. It's just that everyone was talking about the Clippers. As for what it's worth, at the start of the season, I said the Lakers were gonna win the title. But you know, most folks, a lot of folks, Vegas included, and those guys are damn smart, said that the Clippers were gonna win the title. So that's kind of why it's obviously important to talk about them first in this scenario, especially when they have the superstar in Kawhi. But to give the Nuggets some credit, I mean, they lost game 3 to Utah by like almost 40 points. That seems like a year ago. They were down 3-1 to Utah. They were down 3-1 to the Clippers. And for Jamal Murray to catch fire, for Jokic to ball out like this, I mean, Montrezl Harrell was completely unplayable in this series. Finally, late, Doc adjusted for the first time all series and started putting Kawhi on Jokic. It actually ended up not mattering because Jokic was just in such a rhythm and on such fire that he was actually fine even when Kawhi was on him and still very effective. But the way Murray just caught fire from three and the way Jokic passes, I mean, you know, we've always heard the comparisons like, all right, he's a better Bill Walton. He's better than Bill Walton. He's the best passing big man ever. He's one of the best big men ever. I mean, he's 25. So I'm not even trying to label anyone in a historical context at all when they're 25, but we've definitely never seen anything quite like Jokic, at least in the modern era where the Nuggets literally run their offense through this skinny, great passing big, or he's now skinny. He used to be, I guess I just mean like not dominant strength big, who passes so well out of the top of the key. I mean, we've pretty much just never really seen anything like it in the modern era.
I would say unathletic compared to, you know, your average NBA player. Literally can barely jump and is not fast at all, but just incredibly skilled. It reminds me a lot of Boris Diaw, where you just look at someone who's a lot of baby fat on him and not athletic at all, but like crazy skilled for how big he is. And yeah, his passing is a problem. His shooting is a problem. His touch, incredible touch for a big dude. Great rebounding at a ridiculous clip in the playoffs. Yeah, him and Murray are a great 1-2 punch. It just depends on the rest of those dudes. You know, if the role players show up, they'll give the Lakers a series. If not, it'll be 1-2-3 Cancun real quick. But I still think Murray and Jokic are going to have decent numbers again, if not great numbers, in the next series. Just like I said, a lot of it depends on the role players and if they show up.
Totally, yeah. And AD is obviously a much different animal than Harrell or Zubats for Jokic to contend with. But yeah, definitely looking forward to that series. No doubt. All right. You got any final thoughts on that, or should we move on to Celtics Heat?
No, we can move on.
Celtics Heat game one. The Bam block, as I'm going to call it, as maybe many folks have called it. Just an incredible, incredible basketball game. The Heat were down five late. Tyler Hero hits a huge, deep three with 30-something seconds left. Jimmy Butler gets that and one on Tatum, which was just an incredible bucket. It was great defense by Tatum. And Jimmy somehow like hung in the air after taking a long stride and kind of didn't get like a perfect jump off his stride. It was like an awkward shot in the air against contested great defense, gets the and one. On the other end, Marcus Smart flops into a screen that, by the way, I can't remember who it was. I think it was Kemba who maybe shoved the defender into Smart. And then Smart flops, makes the free throw. But that actually might have worked out better for Miami, because instead of attacking the basket on that final possession, the Celtics take like a 29-foot fadeaway angle three with Tatum, and it doesn't go in. And then it goes to OT. Anyways, it was just an incredible game. The Bam block is obviously the highlight of the game on Tatum. Bam is just such an awesome player. And I was talking about this with Pearson Derhalley and John Dunn in a group text. Like, I think I would rather have Bam over pretty much any defensive anchor type player in the league. We were throwing Gobert around. I would rather have Bam than Gobert. And not to make this like just a comparison conversation, but I mean, what Bam does for them is incredible. And it's painful to know that the Blazers could have drafted him, though no one really saw this coming, to be completely fair. But that block was just all time, Big Tony, and a great W by hashtag Heat culture.
He's crazy skilled, man, for a big dude. He's hitting mid-range shots too when people are daring him to shoot them, and the fact that he has that into his already really skilled arsenal is scary. He's only going to get better, but for right now, I mean, he's playable in any scenario. Big, small lineups, he's capable of knocking down shots. He can bring the ball up the floor. Not many bigs can do that. And he's incredible on defense. He blocks everything. And he's just so versatile, too. He can switch out. He really is kind of a Swiss Army knife for bigs. Like, such a luxury to have on your team, just because, like I said, you can play him in any lineup. And that block on Tatum, that's one of the best blocks I've ever seen in any context. And then when you put it into perspective that it was game one of the Eastern Conference Finals to win the game, that was insane. And Tatum took it to the rack hard too. It wasn't like one of those soft layups that he ran as a chase down block. He went to punch it on him and he still met him at the rim. And he was about to throw it down. Like, if you watch the replay in slow-mo, Bam's hand is bent all the way back and he still is able to block it out of the cylinder, essentially. I couldn't believe that play. That was sick. And he's a sick player for sure. I can't wait to see the rest of the series. Because it's with two teams that are so skilled and deep, but they have different players and they have different mindsets from top down in the org. So it should be a battle for sure. I see this one going 6 or 7.
So Bam finishes with 18, 9, and 6. Dragic had 29. He had a really good first half. Crowder with an amazing game, 22 points on 5 of 9 shooting.
Crowder's good now. It's weird. He's like a really good role player now.
Yeah, he shoots a ton of threes. In fact, like the whole Heat team does. Yeah, 9 of Crowder's 11 field goal attempts were threes last night. They all shoot a ton of threes. I mean, I know that's the NBA or whatever the cliche is. That's the modern NBA. But like Crowder literally shoots like 80% of his shots from three, and he actually makes a lot of them. And he actually played really good defense on Giannis last round. Him and Bam kind of combined to do that. So I don't know what happened, but Crowder's really good all of a sudden. Tatum had 30 points, 14 boards, and 5 assists. He's obviously a young, budding star. Marcus Smart has had an amazing stretch here between Game 7 of the Toronto series and just that Toronto series in general. And then he opened up last night, 26 points in Game 1.
And let's see the rest of the team. Kemba had 19. He's really struggling. 6 of 19 shooting. He's had a really rough stretch. Jaylen Brown is just pretty consistent. 17 points, 5 boards. I mean, yeah, I see this series going 6 or 7 as well. These two teams, man, I mean, shoot. I don't know. If you're Philly or Milwaukee, you're kind of looking at these teams like these two teams might be the teams of the future in the East, or even Toronto as well. I mean, obviously that Toronto-Boston series went 7 games, even with Siakam playing as poorly as he did. Obviously, hindsight's 20/20, but if Kawhi was back on Toronto right now, you think that they'd would have had a great shot at beating Boston in the last round. So yeah, man, I like the East. I definitely felt some type of way about the Clippers this year between, you know, the Doc complaining and the Marcus Morris kind of dirtiness and just some random other side antics. I love Kawhi, but the rest of the team I didn't feel great about. But I don't know. I love the Celtics. I love the Heat, and I love the Raptors a lot too. I mean, they're pretty likable teams.
Yeah, and they're way better this year. The East as a whole actually have some legitimate contenders at the top, whereas in years past, it's been pretty bad. But yeah, in terms of the future, the Celtics and the Heat, for sure, especially if the Heat are able to acquire another superstar. I know I keep seeing Giannis to the Heat as a legitimate thing. We'll wait to see about that, folks, on Twitter. But for the Bucks, yeah, you're not feeling too good about the future right now with how you exited. And for the Sixers, you're really not feeling good. There's a lot of uncertainty there with who's going to come in and kind of fix that organization. And then obviously Embiid and Simmons just don't play well together at all. So yeah, and they have terrible contract situations too. They've committed so much money to guys like Al Horford and Tobias Harris. That's a tough scene. But yeah, the Heat and the Celtics are in good position. I'm glad that they're the two teams playing for the right to make the NBA Finals.
Hashtag Heat culture, baby. Speaking of folks on Twitter, did you spend much time on Twitter last night following that Clippers meltdown?
I think I scrolled a few times, but the slander was out of control. I usually try to stay off Twitter. It's too much these days.
Okay, I have a couple receipts that I just want to share here. Gosh, oh man, where did that one go? I thought I screenshotted it. Anyways, okay, so I got a couple highlights here. I just want to quickly show. We had the Jokic picture of Jokic with the do-rag and a couple cigs going. This is at Matthew McGovern. Playoff P, Uncle Dennis online 3, Stephen A smoking tree, call me a manatee, don't matter, Nuggets in 7. Thought that was a good one.
That's a good
Clippers,
one.
The Clippers traded more first round picks, 5, for Paul George than field goals he had tonight, 4. That's a tough look. Ice Cube was out there calling the Clippers a second round dynasty. Because they've never made the conference finals. The franchise has been around for 50 years, folks, and they've never made the conference finals. So Ice Cube is out there calling them a second round dynasty, which I thought was hysterical. And then some savage did like the picture of the player and then someone like squinting and then a picture of a different player in the same uniform. And they had Kawhi and then the squint and then Ronnie Turioff in a Clippers jersey with the cornrow going. And then they had Paul George, the squint, and the Wesley Johnson, I believe it was, with the squint. Anyways, I thought those were funny. folks on Twitter, man. Those folks on Twitter. All right, should we get to the NFL content, Big Tony?
Yeah, we can run through some NFL real quick.
All right, folks, NFL week 1 thoughts. I feel like we need that NFL live pump up music, the Berman highlight music. We'll get production on that later.
God, Berman is the freaking goat, man.
He really is.
Berman is the goat.
He totally is. I love how they're having him on. I haven't been watching it cuz it's on ESPN Plus, but they'll put a minute out of his little rundown highlight that he does, the blitz. I don't know if they're still calling it that, but God, it's awesome. Shout out to Berman, who is one of the goats, as you said. All right,
Big Tony, I thought Burrow looked good in the Bengals loss. His stat line wouldn't say it, you know, 200 something yards, zero TDs and a pick, but he looked confident. He's really interesting as a player. Like I'm on the edge of my seat watching him. And the Bengals are obviously kind of a disaster of a franchise with a young head coach and limited skill players outside of like AJ Green, who is, he has a hamstring issue. Like he's had a hamstring issue like every other week for the last like 6 years, unfortunately, because he's a tremendous talent. Obviously Burrow throws the game winning touchdown to Green, but then he gets called for an OPI. They run it back. Randy Bullock, I believe is the kicker's name, just shanks the field goal wide right. The Bengals basically won that game and then lost it because of the OPI and the missed field goal, which, by the way, the OPI, man, they're all just wrestling back there. It wasn't like a blatant push-off. I don't know. I didn't love it. Same with the Jalen Ramsey, like, semi-flop sell on Sunday Night Football. I didn't love those OPI calls, but I liked Burrow. Russ and Jamal Adams look like, I mean, the best players in the world at their position. Obviously, of course, Mahomes up there with the quarterbacks too, but Russ and Jamal Adams were great as well. And then, I don't know, it might be Herbert time soon for the Chargers. They got the Chiefs this week, so maybe let Herbert sit this one out and then maybe start him after that. But those were a couple of my week one observations.
Tyrod Taylor, baby. Only a matter of time before Herbert gets in there, right? I mean, you know what you're getting with Tyrod. You're getting checkdowns and at best a couple hundred yards for the game, but the offense is stale, man. The offense is stale for sure. I hope Herbert at least plays a few games this year where he gets the full starts. But yeah, that's tough. They did not have a good offensive game. Burrow looked good. That OPI was garbage. So was the one on Jalen Ramsey. That one was terrible. It looked like that was not even like a full extension, and he just kind of flailed and really sold it, especially in that like context of the game so late. But hey, that's a $100 million OPI call, as folks were saying on Twitter. For the rest of the league, let's see. I got to give the Raiders a shout out. They finally won. Still sucks they're in Las Vegas. Still not sure if I'm a fan. But Josh Jacobs is sick, and it's cool to see him ball out. And Henry Ruggs is also really good. I don't know, man. Doesn't look like anyone is going to beat the Chiefs again this year. That's your early week one take. But they're still so loaded on offense. And freaking Clyde Edwards-Helaire is just – that guy is just a freaking Mack truck, man. And the fact that they have him, too, on top of the rest of their offense is something serious. I don't know. I didn't have a lot of, like, crazy takeaways from week one. Like, nothing really stood out. A lot of teams took care of business and a lot of missed field goals, which is kind of weird. But, yeah, those are just, like, the things I can remember off the top of my head.
Yeah, a lot of missed field goals. That's right. Are you – yeah, I guess I think a lot of the folks are curious. Are you pulling for the Raiders as an Oakland native who's a lifelong Raiders fan, but they're obviously playing in Vegas now? What's your kind of stance there?
That's tough, man. I don't know. I'm still torn on it. It's just such an ugly way to end that franchise in Oakland and for everything that happened. And Mark Davis is still a jackass, so it's hard rooting for a guy like that. But I mean, I like some of the players still. I don't know if I'm sold on Gruden yet. And like I said, it just feels weird that they're in Vegas. So I don't know. TBD, man. TBD.
Yeah. I will say Ruggs looked awesome.
He's so good.
Like, he got a little banged up in that game, but he had a couple different routes where I was like, damn, he is good. You know, Derek Carr, I know that a lot of the folks who are Raiders fans who have certainly watched more Carr than I have, I've been slandering him in recent years, but I don't know. Some days he looks like he's a pretty damn good quarterback, and other days he definitely doesn't. But he definitely has days, and this was one of them against the Panthers where you're like, dude, I mean, he's still got it for a couple more years.
Yeah, the problem is he's limited. He checks the ball down so much, and he's the king of throwing the ball away on third down or throwing it short of the sticks, which is just infuriating. He'll never be an elite talent, but he's inconsistent, right? Like low ceiling, but also kind of a low floor. So you're not really getting a whole lot out of him. / the variance there is tough to deal with. So, I mean, I wouldn't mind seeing a little bit of Mariota time, but I know he's hurt right now. He can get healthy at some point.
Yeah. Yeah, he has like a torn pec, I think it is, and he's he's out for a little while. I got Nathan Peterman there backing him up. No, I agree with you on the Chiefs. I agree with you on the
Peterman's
Chiefs.
Peterman's still on the Raiders?
Yeah, Peterman's their backup right now, dude.
Oh, come on, man. That guy's so bad.
He was a hard knock star
worst
for about
NFL
a
NFL players of all time.
For about a week last year when he beat out Glennon for the backup role. I saw Glennon somewhere. God, where is he? He might be the
Buffalo
third
Wild
stringer
Wings?
on the Bears. Yeah. The bar back at Bushwhackers.
Is he serving those is he serving those boneless wings over there in Tualatin?
Yeah. Those boneless wings, baby. Oh,
is
man.
Is he a Bushwhackers filling up those pitchers?
Filling up those pitchers and throwing down some whiskey cokes on Thursday nights.
Just a bunch of moms in tight jeans dancing to that cowboy music.
That is it. That is it on the dot. That is Bushwhackers for you. There's no doubt. And then you get the college kids that come back on every December around winter break. Those two Thursdays around winter break, Bushwhackers. You'd think it's like the hottest club in Miami or something. Like the line is like wrapped around the bar unnecessarily long in the cold. Pretty funny times. I like the Chiefs too. Titans Broncos was a bizarre game where Gostkowski missed those. I think it was either three or four field goals plus the extra point, and then finally redeemed himself at the end by making the game winner. Judy, who is going to be amazing for the Broncos, had two massive drops in that game. One was just like a 25 or 30 yard pass. The other was like a slant, but there was like no one in front of him and he dropped it. He definitely could have housed it. He'll be really good, but those were kind of some weird drops. I guess we should maybe talk about Tampa Bay and New Orleans. Tom with two picks, including a pick six, not the start that he would have wanted. It's obviously, you know, Saints are a really good team. Tough opponent, but they haven't exactly been like a killer top 10 defense in the league year in and year out, so not a great start for Tom. The storyline of who's doing better, Tom or Bill, I'm already over that. I don't even want to go down that road, but Tom struggled. You're not playing the Dolphins at home anymore to open. A little different when you don't have Belichick around you and you're not playing the Dolphins. You're playing the Saints on the road with Arians as your coach. A little different.
Yeah, no more of that free six wins BS where the division is just like basically a handout every year. And obviously without Belichick, it's going to be a little bit harder to win every week. I don't know, man. At this point, he's so old that it's kind of hard to slander him. I mean, his resume is incredible. I always thought he was overrated from the actual position standpoint. Like for the last 10 years of this dude's career, he can't throw the ball further than 10 yards. Just all check downs to James White. But I mean, that's only if you watch the tape. But I don't know, man. At this point, isn't he just too old to kind of rip on? Like if the Bucs don't do well this year and he has kind of a crappy season, what does that really mean? That's kind of like Favre when he was at the very end of his career after that like absurd playoff run that he went on. The year after that, I wouldn't have traded him for a ham sandwich. But, I mean, at that point, he was, what, like 50? It's one of those things where if Brady has a crappy season this year, what does it really mean? I mean, I can't really get on Twitter and roast Tom Brady for throwing pick sixes when he's old enough to be my dad.
No, that's a great point. Brady is 43. I read a stat today that there's only been seven games.
Why is he still playing?
There's only been seven games ever started by a quarterback who's 43 years or older, like in NFL history. And he's about to double that by himself if he stays healthy and plays this season. It's insane, dude. I mean, he's 43 and he's clearly lost a lot of zip on the ball. Like, let's just be real. I mean, he, you know, 07 Brady was chucking that thing. Recent Brady has been checking that thing down. It is interesting why he's still playing. He, you know, I could see them like going like 6-10 this year.
They're probably going to go 6-10. I mean, they play in a really tough division. They have a hard schedule outside of the division. You can't just check the ball down to James White anymore for 10 yards because Belichick has the best offense in the league and McDaniels is his OC. What is he going to do now? I mean, you actually got to throw the ball deep to Mike Evans and Chris Godwin. Now, granted, those guys are amazing receivers, but can't just check the ball down anymore and expect to win games, especially when your defense isn't that good.
That's true. They do have amazing skill around them, but yeah, it was tough. Okay, so they got – let's read this quickly. They got Panthers, Broncos, Chargers, Bears, Packers, Raiders, Giants, and then Saints, Panthers again, Rams, Kansas City.
Jeez, I mean, that's a tough
Minnesota,
schedule.
Minnesota, at Atlanta, at Detroit, Atlanta. Yeah, I mean, that's not easy.
It's not ideal.
You got Carolina in there twice, but other than that, it's not ideal. So,
I agree. Yeah, I agree. In the playoffs.
Yeah, that's going to be tough. Chargers, by the way, to kind of wrap up our NFL talk, Chargers, their schedule quickly. They got Kansas City this week, and they have the Panthers at Tampa, at New Orleans. And then maybe after that at New Orleans game is when we could see Herbert. After that New Orleans game, which is on October 12th, it's home versus the Jets, at Miami, home versus Jacksonville, home versus the Raiders, at Denver. So that's like five very winnable games for NFL standards. That's maybe when we see Herbert, October 18th. Against the Jets. But I wouldn't be surprised if we saw him even before then. But I guess just to wrap up.
And you got a nice little bet on that Herbert thing, don't you?
What do you mean?
You got $50 with NFL Ready, if I remember correctly, right? That Herbert's going to start at least one game this year?
God.
And Marcus Mariota, right?
Thank you for the reminder. I do. God, I forgot about that quick Twitter exchange. Yeah, it was – what is it? It was if either Herbert or Mariota start one game?
Yeah, then he has to pay you $50. Otherwise, you got to pay him $50.
That's right. I'll be shooting him a nice Venmo request. Or maybe I'll just say, hey, can I get a Nike golf polo from the employee store? One of the two. I'll make sure to request it.
You'll make sure to follow up on it.
I was shout out to you, Big Tony. Thanks for the reminder. I was watching some football with NFL Ready in a bar, the Independent Bar and Grill in downtown Portland on Sunday. As Big Steven Peterson, shout out to a listener, is driving to Colorado as we speak with his fiance as they made the move to Denver. But that was kind of a nice. Steven's little Portland going away thing was getting some bros together to watch some football on Sunday, and NFL was definitely sporting his Chargers gear, but I feel very confident in that. Wow. Holy sugar. Buccaneers at Denver. Cheapest ticket was $552. If they let them get in. Oh my God. That's crazy. They must be only letting like a limited amount of people in or something. I know the Jags were like pretty much the only team that let anyone in for the most part, besides like friends and family. But you gotta think that I'm gonna hit that, right? Like Herbert's gonna get a start this year, don't you think?
I don't know about Mariota, but I would assume that Herbert is better than a coin flip.
Yeah. Okay. There we go. Wrapping it up on the NFL observations. Big Tony, who do you think was the best team and worst team after week one?
Best team, KC. The worst team, who got absolutely demolished? The Browns got demolished, but I don't think they're the worst team. They have too much talent to be the absolute worst team. It might be the Dolphins, man. The Dolphins stink. Oh, my God. The Dolphins stink. Dude, you know what? The Dolphins stink like that smell. You used to walk past Carson Hall at the University of Oregon. Remember that smell that used to waft out of there?
Uh-huh.
Remember that, the Carson Dining Hall, whenever you'd walk past there, it would just stink like ass.
Yeah.
That's what the Dolphins stink like, man. Fraternity bathroom smell.
They do. Yeah, 11 points in that game against New England. It's got to be either the Dolphins or the Jets. The Jets are also very sorry, and they lost Jamal Adams. The Jets are very, very sorry. But the Dolphins might even be worse. Yeah, I'm with you. I think we're in agreement there. The worst performance of the week was definitely the Browns. They lost 38-6 to Baltimore. But yes, I'll go Dolphins or Jets as well. You got anything to wrap this one up, Big Tony?
Yeah, really quickly. Now that NFL is back, that means fantasy football is back, and I could not care less about fantasy football this season. I say this every year, I get less and less into it, but it's just such a ridiculous game, man. I mean, like I've said in the past, you're really hoping more for avoiding a bad beat than you are actually like outskilling your opponent, because it's not really skill unless you have a computer program and you can like barely beat a coin flip of an odd to set your lineup to the optimal way. For the most part, it's just rooting for conflicting teams to like have random outcomes where you can beat your buddy by a couple of points because a kicker either shanked or he made a Monday night field goal. It's become such a ridiculous game to me. I mean, it's fun to like be in the leagues and stay in touch with friends, especially if you don't see them all that often and you want to use that as social time. I totally get that. But every year, it's more and more ridiculous. I get less and less motivated with it, especially with the incessant ads from DraftKings and FanDuel about the daily fantasy leagues. I've never been lower on fantasy football, man. I think that it's just such a hack of a game that I could really do without it, but I'm really only in those leagues to kind of stay in touch with friends. That's just how I feel about it.
I feel you, dog. Yeah, my high school league finally like tapped out last year, or this year, I should say. So I am I'm chilling. I do a pick'em, which is actually kind of fun. But
that's fun. You talking about like a survivor pool?
Like you just pick you put in $100 at the start of the season, and if you win, if you're the best, if you pick the most amount of correct results each week, that winner gets $100. So I think I won it twice last year, so I profited $100. It's kind of fun.
That's super fun.
Oftentimes it comes down to the Monday night game too. So yeah, that's kind of a fun way to go.
Yeah, no, that's a blast for sure. Or the survivor pools. Those are fun too. But fantasy football, man, it's a lot of tryhards competing for more or less like a kind of a skill, like not skill less, but pretty lucky title to where you look back and you think to yourself, I guess I won this only because like five other teams that were better than me just all had bad weeks. That's not really my cup of tea there, but yeah, if you're super into it, I guess good for you.
There we go. All right, folks, we definitely appreciate you listening. You got anything else before we sign off, Big Tony?
I got a quick rant about LinkedIn real quick that I think some of the folks here will enjoy / probably resonate pretty well with. LinkedIn has become the new Twitter. It's like the first take for professionals. I keep logging on and seeing my newsfeed clogged with these hot takes in the professional corporate world, which, folks, I know that's kind of hard to wrap your mind around, but imagine Stephen A and Skip and Nick Wright and all the rest of these jokers, except it's corporate talk, not like LeBron versus MJ. It's like, oh, how much did I sell in medical sales this month? It's absurd. They're not like, it's, you know, it's one thing to get on there and congratulate someone or talk about a promotion or talk about a new job. I'm all for that. It is literally a networking platform for you to meet other people and celebrate accomplishments and to reach out and just be better professionals. I totally get that. But when you're getting on there and you're either like slandering someone, which happens all the time, you're bragging about something that probably didn't happen in like a super condescending way, that's not it either. or you get on there to spew some political or other utter nonsense or garbage. I mean, what are you doing? That's like not what the platform is intended for at all. It's a place where people can like have more of a professional image and dialogue. And instead, people are just turning it into another Twitter. So it's all bad, man. Like, it's tough to look at LinkedIn news feeds these days. And I don't know. I wish that platform could be what it was intended to be and cleaned up a little bit and a little more professional and pristine. But alas, here we are. It's 2020.
No, that's a great rant. And one that I resonate with as well. It also feels slight. And again, I think the purpose of it, as you alluded to, is actually really good to network with folks, to be able to reach out to folks in the industry that you're in, or even just a professional who's in maybe a different industry, or a professional at a company who you want to work for. The objective and the initial thought process behind the website seem very valid, and even honorable, like a good way to network. But I'll get on there sometimes, and some of the stuff either seems like somewhat fraudulent, or it almost seems a little bit like Instagram-ish in the sense of like where things seem better than they are, if that makes sense. So like, oh, that person's job seems pretty sick, when in reality it's like their job's not that sick. Like, you get on there and you'll be like, oh, I had a great time meeting with so and so, really pumped, we're rejuvenating this aspect of this industry, and it seems like they're having like a great time. And then you'll talk to that person on the phone and they'll be like, I don't know, dude, I'm just trying to pay the bills. So it seems like, and I'm not even faulting people. I'm not even faulting people for making posts, because they're just trying to, you know, grow their business or their company, or network with other folks. But it is a little bit Instagram-ish, where life seems better than it is.
Can I just read this one? I saw this random post pop up on my timeline. And this is what motivated the rant, folks. This is what someone put as one of their LinkedIn like status or posts. You should be embarrassed, not proud, to tell people you are busy. Being busy equals not being able to manage your time well. Telling someone, sorry, I was busy, is the same as telling someone, sorry, I'm not able to manage my time well. Stop being proud of being busy. Start managing your time better. End quote. What is that? Seriously, what is that? That's such a ridiculous generalization that isn't even true as a generalization, but it's just a reach. It's a reach. It's condescending. It's pretentious. It doesn't even make any sense. So it's like, I see so much of that, as opposed to what I should be seeing is job updates, new friend requests, like networking posts about how companies are doing, things like that. And instead I'm seeing more Skip Baylesses and more Nick Wrights pop up on my newsfeed talking about things that just either aren't true or just are deceiving or fraudulent. Like you mentioned, it's just sad, man. It's not what the platform is intended for.
Yeah, it is funny. It's like corporate jargon on social media. I mean, that's pretty much what it is. Which it's like, corporate jargon is hysterical. I've always made fun of it. I do think like this is a much larger, different conversation, but like the workplace and workplace culture is going to be way different in like A, after the pandemic, but B, in like 5, 10, 15 years. Like, we're going to have a bunch of folks, like when we have kids someday, say like 20 years from now, when our kids are teenagers or whatever the case, like, we're going to be telling them, dude, when we grew up, our dads were working in these like stiff cubicle environments. And hopefully it's not like that in 20 years, but just anyways, that's kind of a different conversation, but the corporate jargon in general, is funny. It's people who you know personally in a completely professional corporate message social media board, which is just like an interesting contrast, because you're like, hey, I was just in a bar with that guy, and now he's speaking the corporate jargon.
And people lying about their sales numbers. I'm just kidding. I don't know, man. It's something else. I had to get that rant off.
These folks on LinkedIn, man. No, good rant. All right, folks. No, we appreciate you listening. Again, we will have Steve Mims, the Register Guard, formerly the Register Guard, next week. He's going to come on the pod and reflect on his two decades in the industry as a sports writer for the Register Guard, covering high school and college and even some pro sports as well. We're going to talk to him about how the industry's kind of changed over the years, what made him get out of the industry, what he liked about it, what he didn't like about it, some of his top funny industry moments over the years, some of the Dana Altman pressers we'll go back and discuss. It's going to be a really good chat with Steve, so I'm sure you guys will want to hear that. We'll obviously post it to our accounts next week after we tape it. So now we appreciate you folks listening, and you guys know where to find us on Twitter, Tony in the Field, on Instagram, Tony in the Field, on SoundCloud, on the iTunes podcast app, and you guys know where to find us. So appreciate you guys listening, appreciate the feedback as well, and we will see you guys next week.